Welcome to my platform, metro.co.uk's new podcast, where we speak to the authors of some of our first person and opinion section's most read articles of the past few years. My platform is all about drawing attention to underheard and underrepresented voices in the media, talking about issues close to their heart. Hosted by me, Jess Austin. I edit the section of Metro that all of our lovely guests submitted their pieces to. As well as being among the most popular articles, they're also some of my absolute favourites, and I can't wait to speak to the authors more about what inspired them, unhindered by a pesky word count. In this series, we'll be having thought-provoking discussions about issues like the pension gap, pretty privilege, and the problematic side of fake tanning. We'll also be shining a light on people's lived experience, covering adoption, HIV diagnosis, and finding love after loss. This week, we're welcoming Chris Lewis and Kate Barron alongside their baby Magnus and dog Jet to the podcast. Chris is the author of Finding Hilda Say, How One Man Walked the UK's Coastline and Found Hope and Happiness. Today, we're going to be discussing Chris's article, I've spent 4 years walking the UK. I left a broken man, but I'm returning with a dog, girlfriend and baby. Hi, Chris and Kate. How are you?
Hi. Thank you for having us. We're very well.
Hello. Thank you for having us on.
So can you start by telling me both a bit about yourselves?
My name's Kate. I am 36 years old and I've been walking the UK coastline alongside Chris now for nearly 3 years, since November 2020. And before I did this, before I started this, I was a teacher in East London. I trained teachers, but always loved adventure. And I guess it was a sort of serendipitous twist of fate that found me alongside Chris on this.
Amazing. And Chris, how about you?
My name's Christian Lewis. I am 40. How old am I?
43.
Sorry. Took a while.
Time just stood still for us.
Yeah. It doesn't really make it happen for us. So I started walking the UK coastline on the 1st of August, 2017. I was a former parachute regiment soldier. And I, a single parent after that. And cut a long story short, I had a bit of a wobble. And, I decided the only thing that was going to fix me was just being outside long term and doing something to raise money for the charity that helped me suffer. So nearly 6 years later, and here we are with this little one.
Amazing.
Who's decided he wants to be part of it.
Well, Magnus is a little spoiler alert of what's going to happen in your story. But, so obviously the article we had was from your perspective, Chris, but we want to hear about what inspired you both. But we'll start with your story, Chris. Can you tell me what was happening in your life in 2017 that made you want to take this step, literally?
Yeah, so I've been suffering for quite a long time with anxiety and depression. You know, I really wasn't in a good headspace at all. And I was very soon made to become homeless. And my daughter had really picked up on the fact that I wasn't in a particularly good place at the time. So she decided it was best that she were to leave and, you know, go down to Bournemouth, where she was going to go to college and then to university. And then when she left, I just found myself in this really kind of surreal and strange place of just complete lostness. I didn't know what to do, where to go, or if what I was doing or what I thought about doing was even going to in any way, shape or form help, you know, to get myself better. So I decided there and then on the spot one day after having a surf just to go and literally walk the entire UK coastline. There was no plan. I had absolutely no idea how it was going to work. I had no money. I didn't even have the gear at the time. You know, I just love being outside so much. It was my safe place. The one place I loved more than anything was just going for a surf. And that's the only time I felt in any way, shape or form slightly happy. So I just decided one day that after going for a surf that, do you know what, if I love being out here so much that then continue doing that, I really didn't want to go back to the house that I was, well, the flat that I was staying in at the time. It did nothing positive for me. So yeah, there and then on the spot, I just, something in my head just said, walk the UK coastline. And a couple of days later, I left. I literally had a pair of boots that didn't fit, a tent that had a hole in it. Everything was borrowed from friends. I even had this knife that looked like something Crocodile Dundee would use, and soon realised that actually probably walking around the coast, going into bigger cities and towns wouldn't be appreciated. So, it was a very rough start to what, you know, ended up as the most beautiful journey.
And when did you decide that you were going to do it to raise funds for Soldiers, Sailors, Airmen and Families Association?
Pretty much as soon as I had the epiphany. It was very, a light bulb moment. And then there's a guy called David Singletree from South Wales SAFO. He was the head of SAFO at the time, and he was just relentless with me. He was always coming down checking that I was okay, even though he knew that I didn't want him to I couldn't see that at the time, but, you know, certainly after a while, I could really see, you know, how much his input, if you like, and just general sort of, you know, someone cares, the effect that had on me. So it was just an absolute no-brainer. The second I made the decision, I started walking back towards the flat, and within minutes, you know, right, I'm going to do this for Safa. So it was an absolute no-brainer for me.
And did you have any plans of how you get by with your holy tent and your shoes that fit wrong? Did you just hope that things would work out, or just go into it?
No, there was no plan whatsoever. It really, I tell you how unplanned this was the day that I left. Where I started, I had to walk through sort of like a little sandy alleyway to get onto the main beach, Llangennyth in Swansea. And if I turned left at that beach, it would have meant that I would have started heading south down to England and then do the south coast first. If I went right, it meant I would have started heading up towards Scotland. And as I came onto the beach, I saw a group of, I think they were friends, I don't know, they were too far away, but I saw people surfing down at a place called Peaks, which is at the very end of Llangennyth. So I turned right just to go and watch a bit of surf before I started, and just continued in that direction. So I had a tenner, which I spent on the very first day. And yeah, I think, you know, I don't know how I'd done it, if I'm perfectly honest with you. It's a lot of hard work and starving. You know, I lost a lot of weight, and, you know, I was even rummaging through bins and all sorts of stuff. So yeah, it was the most unplanned journey going. But I also think that, you know, for something like this, there's probably no better way to do it. I think what I, you know, in my mind, subconsciously, what I wanted was to break away from the whole routine and the whole ideology of, okay, I have to get here, or I'm going to plan my day, you know, religiously like this. So I wanted to get away from all that. And actually, it turns out to do something like this, you can't plan it. You know, the weather dictates your journey, your body dictates your journey. So you just have to read and listen to those two things very carefully. And 6 years later, we're still going.
And the action, I imagine the action of stepping out of your flat on that first day, probably just, it's not easy. I imagine it was kind of a weight lifted. You knew that you had kind of a purpose and something to drive you forward. Now, did you feel lighter straight away, or was it, I imagine it was a very long journey?
Yeah, going back to what we were just saying, that's a very interesting point. The further I was getting away from that flat, the more pressure I felt easing off me. I don't know why, but in my head, I'd built this strange scenario that just everybody was after me, you know, a knock at the door, you know, and I was running into a corner like some sort of Russian spy was after me or something. It was ridiculous now that I think back. But the further away that I got away from Swansea, the more relief I felt. And I did not because of Swansea, because of the life that I'd built for myself there. So, you know, I love Swansea and I love the Gower where I lived, but, you know, I had made it a not very good place for myself. So, yeah, the further away I got, the more relaxed I became. You know, I wouldn't so much as say I was running away from my problems. I just needed to get away to be able to take a step back and reassess life and all of that sort of stuff. So, yeah, it really, really helped in that respect.
And you mentioned, obviously, you left your house with not quite the right kit, but you encountered some really, really lovely strangers. Do you mind telling me a bit about these people who helped you?
Yeah, so, you know, I put a lot of hard work and effort. It wasn't long into the journey that I realised that, you know, speaking to people for the charity to get the donations in and also to, you know, up my profile a little bit was incredibly important. So I would spend a lot of time chatting with people, and the more I'd done it, the more confident I became, and the more I started to see, wow, there is just so many good people. In fact, so many better people out there that are amazing than are not so good. So, you know, I spent a lot of time on this journey, as has Kate, you know, experiencing just general lovely kindness from people that don't want anything back in return. They just, being kind can also be quite a selfish thing, because if you're nice to somebody, then it makes you feel good inside. So, you know, that when someone's nice to me, it makes me feel good and I want to go and do it to somebody else. So paying it forward the whole time. So it was definitely a game changer in the way that I saw things. And yeah, listen, people are absolutely amazing. And, you know, once you start getting them out of the woodwork, you realize that the UK is, you know, surrounded by them.
But you also came into a bit of a struggle very soon into, well, a couple months in that lockdown happened. What happened then?
So I had just finished the hardest thing I think I've ever had to do in my life, which was a winter in a tent in Shetland. Shetland is a whole different ballgame when it comes to weather. It's it's something else. It can be brutal. So I was really, really proud of that fact. And I was only about 3 weeks away from finishing Shetland. And I'd heard about COVID and I hadn't heard about COVID because I wasn't watching press. You know, I wasn't reading press. I wasn't watching the news. I wasn't listening to radio. I really just kind of trying to absorb what was going on around me, you know, in a physical sense, if you like, rather than I just wanted no negativity in my life, if you like. So I didn't know anything about it. And a fisherman called Victor knew where I was and come down to see me and was like, "Chris, you know, we're going into lockdown tomorrow." I was like, "Lockdown? What the hell is that?" And he just said, "Look, we've all got to stay at home." So immediately I was like, "Okay, I'm going to have to just go pitch the tent and stay there for however long this was going to be," because at the time we didn't know how long it was. And he just said to me, "Look, there's an island, a good bit out to sea that is totally uninhabited. Do you want me to go and take you over there? At least that way you can roam around and do stuff." And, you know, because of my thirst for adventure and how much I'd loved the sort of, right, this sounds awesome, let's just go and do it, you know, throughout the journey, it didn't even take me a second to think about it. I was like, "Yeah, let's go." There was no sort of, like, how am I going to do this? How am I going to eat? All this kind of stuff just didn't even come into my brain. It was more of a, let's deal with that when it comes to it. It dropped me off on this island with some supplies, and it turned out, I think it was three and a half months on a totally uninhabited island, which was an incredible experience, I can tell you that much. It was really funny because I really felt sort of, I've always described it where I didn't have much in the way of being able to have contact with my phone or anything, but I had enough to be able to at least see what was going on and keep a check on things. And I really felt like I was kind of floating above everybody because I got myself out of it and just watched how crazy everything just went, you know, how mad people were going over toilet rolls and all these kind of things. And, I felt really blessed to be one of the very few that were lucky to have 108 hectares of land to kind of roam around on and do as I please. Just really focus on other things that I wanted to do. For me, lockdown was very much of a, how can I improve on things, you know, and get better and learn more? So I used it as an opportunity rather than I didn't wallow on the fact that, you know, I had to stay in the same place for that. I used it as an opportunity, and I came out fitter, healthier, and with a lot more knowledge after 3.5 months. So I was very proud of that.
Also, it sounds like you had the diet of a king and that you were foraging lobsters and crabs.
Yeah. Well, it took a lot of practice, you know, but I knew the one thing that is dangerous was the fact that, not keeping yourself occupied, not keeping yourself busy. That's where boredom sets in, and that's where you can start becoming unhappy. So, yeah, I made it a real target for myself to say, "Look, I'm going to do this today. I'm going to do that today. I'm going to fill my day with things." And I would say the majority of that was things like foraging, you know, trying to catch lobster and crab and all that sort of stuff. And I just really enjoyed it. And the satisfaction of eating a good, healthy meal that you've worked hard to get is just wonderful. You know, it knocks spots off going shopping and putting it in the oven, I'll tell you that much.
And before we move on to how you met Kate shortly after, I just want to loop back as well about your experience in Northern Ireland, because you were initially planning on skipping going there because of your military history, but you found a message in a bottle?
Yes, that's right. I was on the west coast of Scotland, a place called Mull of Galloway, and I was walking with somebody at the time who had a dog. Cut a long story short, this dog brought over this bottle and it had a message in it. So we managed to, through the press, somebody I knew who worked for the Mirror in Northern Ireland, track the guy down. I'm really glad that we found it, because I would have been very annoyed with myself if I'd have stopped. Had I stopped, not gone over to Northern Ireland for political reasons. So I think in a way, finding that bottle and wanting to return it to the guy was a little kick up my backside, just to say, "Do you know what, sod it all. You know, if you want to go and do it, do it. Don't let anybody or anything or how I feel about it, you know, stop you from doing that." So, it very much spurred me on to go over there. And we did. We went over to Northern Ireland. We met up with the guy, returned the bottle, obviously told him to stop littering. It was a wonderful moment. It really, really was. And from that point, I went and started walking it.
And the message, just for anyone who hasn't read the piece, was over 30 years old from a 9-year-old boy talking about his best friends and hobbies. And he included his name and return address. What was it like when you apart from telling him to stop muttering, was it nice? Was he shocked? Did he even remember putting this message?
Oh, he remembered it. Yeah, yeah. He was so grateful. You know, he's grown up now. He has a very serious job, and he was just a really lovely, humble guy. And you know, he said to me afterwards, we did the thing with the press. They wanted to get some pictures, and he said, "Look, you know, I've got children now, so you know, I'm going to be able to take this message and frame it and give it to my children to have on their wall and stuff like that. Something we'll keep for life." So, yeah, it was a really warm moment, if you like. And yeah, I'll never forget that. It was wonderful, and I hope to meet up with him again one day.
And was that kind of you had that warm moment? Were you also reflecting on how your mental health was improving as well at this point?
I mean, it definitely was. There's no doubts about it. You know, I was definitely talking to more people. I'd become very recluse before I set off for this journey. I just always kept myself to myself. So in that respect, yes. But I would say the real change in that for me was when I started to hit the more wild parts of Scotland. For example, the west coast of Scotland. You know, once you start getting up to Oban sort of area, you really do start getting some big sections of Scotland there. Very uninhabited, as with the inner and outer Hebrides. And you know, when I first started this, for a long time I thought of myself as a homeless man that was walking around the UK coast. But at this point, I'd learned so much, one about myself, you know, my limits and all this sort of stuff. So my confidence was growing back in me. I was starting to feel a bit of pride again. I would say the main thing was when you are in a position where, I mean, don't get me wrong, we all have to do this every single day, basically. But when you're living out in a tent, and your main focus every single day has just stripped you back simply to food, water, and somewhere safe to sleep for the evening. And believe me, at times that really wasn't easy, especially up in Scotland. The weather's, you know, very different up there. Doing winters out in Scotland in a tent, you know, isn't fun at the best of times. But it was at that point, I think, where my focus had just solely become on this. So all of the white noise, if you like, was just going. It was just slowly dispersing from my mind. I was thinking less and less about all of the things that had plagued me before, and more about what I was doing. So it took time. It really, really did. But I would say after a few years, it was when I arrived on Hildersay, basically, the island that I lived on during lockdown, was the first time that I had stopped on the walk. So I was really, really worried that it was just a plaster. And that now that I'd stopped, maybe this would all start happening. But I realized then that the walk was far from a plaster. It was simply a life-changing thing, because I just felt more determined and more ready for anything. And, you know, although I don't own anything, and really don't now, to be honest with you, but I still feel like the world's my oyster, which is it's a very true saying that the less you have, I think they're saying something along the lines that the less you have, the easier it is to grow, if you like. And in many respects, that's so true. You know, had I not just had nothing and I had responsibilities and things to think about all of the time, then, you know, I'd probably be in the same position.
And you had a very important companion on Hildersay, which was Jet. How did you meet him?
So Jet's a girl. How'd you hear that, Jet?
Oh, sorry.
she's a girl. I got her on the west coast of Scotland just as I just finished Northern Ireland and came back over. And it was basically Ayrshire, a place called Irvine. And she belonged to a family that just unable to have her anymore. So I adopted her. And yeah, that was, you know, to this day, bar obviously Kate and Magnus, I have to say that. You know, it was the best decision that I'd made on the walk, because she's just so beautiful, so loyal. She never leaves my side, and you know, she never barks. I can see that kind of, you know, dogs have this wonderful way of just showing you how much they love you just by a look. And at times when I needed that, she was always there to give it to me. So yeah, it was just perfect. It was a perfect relationship, and she was the perfect dog to come and join me on what would be, you know, some seriously testing parts of the walk when it comes to the physical side of it.
And when lockdown ended, what was your plan?
Just to get on with it, basically. So, you know, I knew that all I had to do was 3 weeks left in Shetland. Then it was back to mainland Scotland, the northeast tip. And then I would be going down towards England. But this was all going to be a huge change again, that I didn't realise would bring in some serious challenges of its own, coming into more built-up areas, you know, bigger cities. I hadn't seen a city. Last city I'd seen was Glasgow. So I hadn't seen a city for about 2.5 years before I ended up getting down to Inverness. So it was quite a culture shocker. You know, concrete jungle is definitely the word. I felt completely sort of like out of my place, if you like. And it's so funny because when you spend so long in the wilds, I really do believe that your hearing becomes more acute. You know, you're not listening to, you know, we don't realize it. You're walking through a town and you're listening to thousands of different noises and loud ones, buses, ambulances and planes going over. And when you suddenly strip from all that, you realize, blimey, this is what peace sounds like. And so it was a real culture shock for Jet and I. You know, she was jumping every 30 seconds, every time a car went past. And even I was a bit spun out by it. But, you know, hey, all part of the adventure.
And where did you meet Kate?
So I met Kate on the northeast tip of Scotland. It's a place called the Wallago Steps. It's just below Wick. Kate had been doing a solo adventure of her own. And I just happened to be camped at the bottom of these steps called the Wallago Steps, a very famous set of steps in Scotland. And down she pondered. And we had a really, really brief interaction, probably 5 minutes. I was immediately struck by her. I actually had somebody else talking to me at the time. He was asking me questions, but I was immediately struck. You know, Kate just kind of barged her way and it was like, oh, you know, I'm really interested about what this guy's got to say. Do you mind if I ask a few questions? Because I've got to go. So we spoke literally a few minutes and then she left. About 40 minutes later, or 40 minutes to an hour later, she came back down with a big bag, some fish and chips and 2 cans of Tennent's and said, look, I'm trying to find a place to camp. Do you mind if I come and camp next year? Really, what it was, she saw me and she was just like, God, you know, I really, really fancy him. It wasn't. she came down and that was that. We spent the night just talking the entire evening and just, you know, just understanding. I think we both have a serious love for the great outdoors and for adventure. And, you know, it really just started from there.
Chris mentioned you were a solo camper. What brought you to the northeast coast of Scotland? Was this the first trip you'd made? What gave you a love for wild hiking?
Yeah, I'd always had a love for travel, which I think had stemmed from my university days. I did French and Spanish as a degree. And as part of that, I spent a year living in Mexico when I was 20. And I just really fell in love with adventure on that year, fell in love with Mexico, that whole region, Latin America, and spent lots of time in my 20s traveling through Central America, through South America, and often with friends. I was a teacher at the time in East London, so I often traveled with friends during the holidays. But I think there'd always been a craving in me to experience longer trips again, you know, maybe live abroad again or maybe do more adventurous stuff. And I was looking to really push my limits a bit more on that front and really learn more about how to do more expedition style stuff. It wasn't until I was 30 that, you know, lots of my friends, it just wasn't an option anymore to travel with friends. You know, people were settling down, getting married, having kids, and that just wasn't on the radar for me. And so it became a thing of, right, if I want to still do this, I'm going to have to just bite the bullet and do it on my own. And I started to travel on my own. And, you know, I first went off to places, pretty far flung places. So, you know, I went off to Belize, to Colombia, Hawaii, literally with my backpack, with a tent, and just, you know, would gallivant around on my own for a month and just make it up as I went, and did a lot of solo hiking and wild camping on those trips. And I think having done that, my confidence just built up, you know, over the years. And when I was 33, 2019, I actually quit my full-time job as a teacher in East London, with the aim that I would focus on my teacher training career, which I've been doing on the side, and also travel, and hopefully then sort of really learn more survival skills and really get into more solo expeditions. And then, you know, that was starting to take off. I had a pretty good gig going on. And then COVID hit, which basically scuppered all of my plans and meant that I had nowhere to go and all my travel plans were cancelled. I had to go and move in with my mother. Oh. As I'm sure is the case for many people out there. So I did lockdown with my mum, and during that time I tried to keep really busy. I mean, I was just doing online classes for free for some of my old students. And then I actually got a contract with the government to do a whole load of educational videos to pump out during lockdown for schools to use for online learning and also for parents to use for homeschooling. You know, I led a team of 12 teachers to produce a huge amount of video content, a whole year's worth of video content over a period of about 3 to 4 weeks. And it was so intense. And just as that project finished, I was really proud of that project. It was super intense, but it meant that people had this content to use that would really help them when they were at a loss with what to do with their kids at home. Yeah. And, you know, it's one of those things where when I actually started the walk, I'd be sat in a tent up in freezing temperatures in the dark in Scotland. And I would still have these kids sending me their work via Twitter. And I would be sat in the tent at night, like still making sure whenever I got any work sent to me from a child, you know, that I would give them feedback and stuff. That was really important to me. Quite a surreal contrast, but yeah, anyway, so once that finished, I just was in desperate need of adventure once the lockdown had lifted, and I bolted the next day with no plan, just bolted up to Scotland. And I had a sort of rough idea that I was going to do my own take of the North Coast 500. I didn't want to do the North Coast 500 exactly, because I always like to go off the tourist trail and just do my own thing. For me, sort of as wild and remote and off-grid adventure is what I like. So yeah, that's what I was doing. And on the last day of my trip, I went down a set of 360 steps to the bottom of this cliff, a place called the Wallago Steps near Wick on the northeast tip of Scotland. And I just saw this bloke camped up there. He was actually fixing a tent pole at the time, fixing a broken tent pole. And obviously he's got a very distinct look. He had this woolen hat, which was hand knitted in Shetland on. I think he had wetsuit boots on, his kilt, this very sort of rugged looking kilt, torn and tattered looking kilt. And just looked like he'd been doing this for so long. Then he had this beautiful dog next to him. And I just immediately needed to, you know, approach him and sort of ask what he was doing. Because at the time I felt like there were some parallels between us. You know, we were both out there wild camping in this, you know, in the Scottish sort of wilderness, if you like. And I needed to, felt like, oh, I'm going to find out what he's up to. So we just had this really brief encounter, and then I left, and then sort of 40 minutes later, I couldn't get him out of my head. And so I just did a U-turn, came back, and we camped next to each other for the night, stayed in touch. And then, you know, I ended up joining the walk full time.
Amazing. So you had to go back to London the next day. How long did you stay in touch before you, 2 months later, you made the decision to join Chris?
When I left the next day, I think I just thought, oh, right, you know, it'd be nice to stay in touch every so often. And then maybe I'll come up and see you again and we can do a week of walking together next time I'm free. But, it, you know, it ended up where actually we ended up texting every day, and then it got into pretty nonstop contact. And yeah, a few weeks later, it was, I think it became clear for both of us that there was more to it than just friendship. So 6 weeks later, we had a first date in a bothy. I flew up to Inverness, and then somebody that was following the journey picked me up from the airport alongside Chris, and we went to a bothy for 4 days on the Black Isle. So I sort of spent 4 days in the wilderness with Chris, living his life. So as a first date, I guess it was pretty out there, sort of collecting wood for fires, distilling seawater over the fire, like sword throwing, literally, not swords, with his knife. Yeah, we did knife throwing, chopping wood, all that kind of stuff. But it was really magical, a magical first date, really. I think by the end of that, we knew that, yeah, this was something real and we both wanted to pursue it. And so, yeah, I actually ended up going to Afghanistan for 2 weeks. And then as soon as I got back, literally, I went straight from the airport up to go and see him. And then I never went home again.
Wow. Did you have any concerns about like being in a tent full time, 24/7 company with someone that, you know, you just kind of felt a connection with, but you just met essentially?
Yes. Although I think that was probably more of an issue for Chris than me. Chris, having spent 3 years on his own in the wilderness, he, you know, when he met me, he just finished 3 years pretty much doing all of, you know, the most remote parts of Scotland and in serious isolation, really, just him and Jet. So to have somebody else suddenly come on board, in fact, before me, no one else had ever been inside his tent. So it's that space, you know, that had become so sacred to him. I think it was just like the tent was a sacred place. That was his home. So whilst he met a lot of people on the journey, you know, that space was his. and to let somebody else into that after it being his for so long, I think he, you know, was quite big. It was a huge thing for him. And also to have somebody else who had a strong personality and was going to have a voice on this adventure now, you know, that was something that he also had to get used to. I mean, for me, I don't know. I thought that we just got on so well. And I felt like, I don't know, I felt like I was pretty easygoing as a companion. So it would probably be okay. But
she's not.
But don't get me wrong, 24/7, you know, Chris and I have actually spent pretty much 24/7 together for, yeah, the last 3 years. And it is very intense. But I think having gone through that, you just get to know that person so well inside out, and you go through, you support each other and forgive each other through so, and just, I don't know, love each other and laugh together through so much that you end up with this like huge amount of love and respect for each other. And that's a wonderful thing. I think, you know, in 3 years, our relationship has been so intense over a short period of time that we've got a lifetime of memories already.
Yeah. And obviously you've had to overcome challenges like being thrust into another lockdown shortly after you joined him and being in Scotland where temperatures got to minus 17. Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah, even I was surprised by that. I didn't know that temperatures there could get that low, but lo and behold, they did. So soon after I joined, we were Scotland. It was slightly earlier, I think, when Scotland went into the second lockdown. So from Boxing Day, and yeah, we didn't at the time. We were, near the new Slains Castle up somewhere in Aberdeenshire. Near Gordon, and yeah, we needed to find somewhere to spend the lockdown. Again, we didn't know how long it was going to be. There were certain things that we needed to have around us, you know, to make sure we had a lifeline, like most important being wood for fires, because that was our source of being able to keep warm. We needed signal, we needed access to a village that wasn't, you know, a million miles away, because we'd have to walk every day to get supplies and things like that. So yeah, we ended up in a woodland right off the coast, and we were there for 3.5 months, you know, till mid-April, and in a tent. And it was in February time, it did get down to minus 17, and it was bitterly, bitterly cold and freezing, and it was hard. But Chris and I just made a pact that we would make the best of it, and that we would do things to keep ourselves warm every day. So we, you know, we worked out every day, we would go running around the field and do makeup sort of fitness routines, we would dance, we would cook every night, we made these huge stews, we made a shelter, which took us a month just from fallen logs we found around the woods, and we stacked it all up with mud. We made it sort of an extra shelter to live in. So we did all sorts during the lockdown, which actually, looking back, you know, yes, it's one of the hardest times, but it was by far one of the most memorable and special experiences of the whole thing. And even to this day, people that pass through send us pictures of our shelter, which still stands in that wood.
You're making me jealous. And I you know, wasn't in minus 17 temperatures, but that sounds lovely.
it was almost like there was a very romantic aspect to it, actually. And I think both of us really thrived off. I learned particularly a lot during that time, of, you know, in terms of survival skills. I learned from Chris about how to make fires in all weathers. I was really keen to learn from him. And, you know, I think actually, hard as it was, sometimes stripping your life, Chris probably mentioned this, but when you strip everything right back to basics and you're working so hard for just your main survival needs, shelter, food, water, life just becomes those that you feel so much more gratitude for those things that you normally take for granted.
And so when lockdown lifted, you started to walk again. And then shortly after, you discovered that you were pregnant. What was that like?
Yeah, that was quite surreal. So we found out the day after my 35th birthday. We were staying in a leaky shed on some hay bales next to two horses on the east coast of Yorkshire. It was unexpected, to be honest. It was a planned thing. Like we had decided, let's, you know, we both wanted to have a child, wanted to start a family, and we actually thought, probably after this walk, we would go on to do something much more extreme, maybe, you know, find ourselves somewhere like Antarctica. So maybe it'd be best if we were going to do it, just take the plunge, like, you know, is our mentality with everything, and go for it, see what happens. And at least we'd be in the UK. And I just got pregnant really quickly, and yeah, I had to make peace with the fact that I was definitely going to be having a baby on this walk and that we would still be quite a long way from the finish line when baby came along. I made a, in my head, there was no reason why I couldn't carry on. So I just, when I knew I was pregnant, I thought, okay, well, we just continue as we always have. So I just walked every day through the pregnancy, while I was camped every day through the pregnancy until 37 weeks. And I actually had a really smooth pregnancy. I had no morning sickness, no illness whatsoever. I felt, you know, really fit and healthy the whole time. And I really think that being outdoors and walking so much actually must probably really helped with that.
Yeah, so Chris wrote the article when you were 5 months pregnant. So you had a really smooth pregnancy. That's fantastic. You planned to give birth en route and then walk to the finish line in Swansea. What happened after you gave birth to Magnus?
Well, the birth wasn't exactly, you know, what I had hoped. So I ended up, the plan was to have a water birth in a yurt on the Dorset coast. So that, I was there for about 16 hours before I ended up in hospital having an emergency C-section. And I did have quite a traumatic recovery. Postpartum experience was very difficult. But, you know, so we left at 3 months after I had the surgery with Magnus, rather than, I thought we were going to be able to take off, you know, 2 weeks later, and I'd just breastfeed him over the cliffs and you know, I'd sort of pop him out and Bob's your uncle, I'd be off on the cliff tops with him. But that wasn't the case. You know, it was all much more complicated than that. So, but yeah, once we got the go ahead at 3 months that I was fit enough to be able to ease myself into walking again, we set off from where we left off, which was sort of just before Hastings, and then walked the whole of the South Coast, you know, with him. I carried him on my front until he was 9 months old and old enough to go in a backpack. So during that time we did all along from Kent, all the Channel Islands, all the way through Dorset. And then, yeah, you know, just kept going. He's now, we've done all of the South Coast with him, all of the Southern Islands. He's now 13 months old, and yeah, still carry him to the finish line.
And are there any challenges that come with camping with a newborn or now 18 month old?
Yeah, I think Chris and I both hoped that, naively perhaps anticipated, that we'd be able to just carry on wild camping, carry Magnus alongside all of our, you know, the Bergens that we had, as we had before. And when he came along, it was just very apparent that we just could not carry him alongside everything else, all of the water we would need, all of the supplies. So we ended up getting a van through the help of a follower, just an old VW, just a fold down bed. There's no amenities in it at all, but it just meant that we had a backup, because if we needed to get to a doctor, if there were any medical emergencies for whatever reason, you know, we needed to be independent as parents to be able to do that, and have a backup where we could store some of the stuff and somewhere for shelter in bad weather for him. So that van was a real game changer, and we had to get used to using that. It made it more complicated in terms of the walking in lots of ways, but it was essential for Magnus's safety. So that was a big change. And then also just, you know, I couldn't breastfeed. So I was pumping for 5 months, which had challenges in terms of cleaning the pump and doing that on the walk. Also then weaning, because sterilizing the bottles, you know, we would have to sterilize every morning and every night. We'd have to boil water to sterilize the bottles, boil water to fill the bottles for the milk. We couldn't heat the milk up, you know, easily. We didn't have a microwave or anything, or a hob. So, you know, weaning him was also really challenging. And worked really hard on that, given that we just cook on a gas stove outside and we can't have fires in England, really, because it's, you know, it's frowned upon, to say the least. So, yeah, all sorts. But I think actually Magnus has taken so well to living outdoors. He sleeps better in a tent than he does anywhere else. He loves his outdoor life. He's so alert. He's just got this absolute love and curiosity for nature and the world around him. He's so active, you know, strong. He's a very strong, adaptable little boy. He's in a different place every day. sometimes we're in a tent, sometimes we're staying in someone's spare room, sometimes we're in a barn, a shed, you know, all sorts. And he just adapts. So, yeah, I think we've given him a great start in life, and I'm proud of that.
Amazing. And you mentioned as well, like, that you've been staying in people's spare rooms, that someone gave a van. So have you still encountered a lot of kindness of strangers as your story has spread?
Oh, yeah, hugely. I never expected to have the kind of the level of kindness that we've experienced on this walk when I joined. I just am still to this day, like, completely bowled over by the kindness that we've experienced. When Magnus was born, you know, we were in this yurt, and the post that was coming day after day, people asking for an address so they could send things. We've got ladies, we've got people all over the UK knitting him, you know, hand-knitted hats and cardies and all sorts. I'd say nearly everything that he wears is donated from people. So many beautiful gifts that we've received. And yeah, you know, we never took indoor accommodation before Magnus was born. We always wild camped for the purity of living outdoors, and also to raise awareness of the homeless. We've done a lot of that on the walk, sleeping rough in cities along the way to try and spread awareness about that. But since he came along, yeah, Magnus and I would take a room in a house. And that's been lovely, getting to know people on a different level, sort of more intimately in people's homes along the way as we've gone. So yeah, a huge amount of kindness, and it's been a phenomenal part of the journey.
How long do you have left to go, if you have a firm number on it? Do you know what's your plan of action now?
So yeah, we're going to be finishing the walk on the 29th of July. So you know, much less than a month to go. It's just, I can't get it into my head, to be honest with you. I've been doing it for so long that it's become such a lifestyle that, I can't even process that yesterday we came back into Wales, you know, the country where I started. So, it's a very strange feeling for me and Kate at the moment, but certainly for the fact that I started here. You know, it was a big moment yesterday to come back into Wales. It really, really was. So I'm yet to run into a cupboard and shed a little tear of joy.
Well, you had Saffra cheering you on as you crossed over. Is that, yeah?
Yeah, Saffra were there. We had the press there. You know, loads of people came, which was just so lovely. You know, people that have been following for years. And it was just the most wonderful welcome back into Wales. It really was. We had people on either side of the bridge, you know, as we were coming over the bridge to go back into Swansea. And when we arrived, in Wales, when we arrived back in Wales, there was just hordes of people there to welcome us. So it was very special.
Currently, so as of the time that I was researching before the podcast, you've raised £329,000 for the charity. How does that feel?
Amazing. You know, I set off with a target of 100,000. You know, how do you put a target on something like this? I had no idea. But I set a target of 100,000. I hit that when I was in Hildersey. And so to have, you know, far more than tripled that is unbelievable. You know, I just feel so good. And, you know, I've paid them back for the help they gave me and more. So, you know, it's a nice feeling inside to know that you've done something. You know, £330,000, I think, with a gift aid is 410 or something like this. I still don't even know what that means. But either way, you know, it's a large wadge of money that will make a difference. And but I think equally to the money, I think one of the nicest parts about the walk is the fact that the amount of people that I've connected with who themselves are going through a bad time or have been through a bad time or anything like this. And the kind of connection that I've had with them is to me personally is as important as money.
And you wanted to return a happy man. That was your goal. And you will. What does that mean to you?
I mean, everything is just, look, you know, one of the things, I think probably the most important thing that this walk has told me is to, you know, pursue what you love doing. You know, I made the mistake, and I think a lot of people make the mistake, and I think that's because it's very difficult to be able to do this, of squeezing the things that I love doing in life in and around the routine that I had. Whereas now there is no squeezing. I you know, I've been able to build a life for myself where I don't need many things. You know, I'm happy being in a tent. You know, we're all happy either being in a van or a tent. So we don't need 5 houses, 30 cars, computers, laptops, all this kind of different stuff to make us happy. So when you don't need that, you'd be surprised how much money can be ploughed into just doing things that you love doing. And fortunately for us, most of the stuff that we love doing doesn't really cost anything apart from a bit of fuel and some hard work. So, you know, I found a purpose in life, and I think that's probably for somebody out there with mental health issues, certainly speaking from my perspective, is the most important thing of all, just having a purpose and focusing on something you love. You know, there's a quote, a lot of people fail at doing things they don't enjoy, so you may as well take a chance on doing, failing at the stuff you love. And I think that's very relevant.
And once you get back to Swansea, what is your, do you have a plan? Are you just going to go into it and embrace the moment again?
No, you know, Kate and I are definitely the kind of people, there's no doubts about it, especially after doing this for so long. I've always been like it. And I know Kate has, just, you know, through her traveling experiences, whenever Kate wasn't working, she was out doing something adventurous, and vice versa, you know, same with me. So I know for a fact that we'll probably say to each other, right, we'll go to Swansea and stay there for a little bit and then just go do something else. But we won't be there for long. We're just going to go straight off and carry on adventuring. It's what we love doing.
Thanks for listening to my platform and to Chris and Kate's experience. Please leave us a rating and a review. It really helps people to find the podcast. Our main aim with this podcast is to give a platform to underheard voices, offering a human first story to accompany some of the most prevalent topics in the news. We'd love to hear if Chris and Kate's story helped shape your view. If so, please let us know on Twitter at Metro Opinion or by email at platform@metro.co.uk. My platform is produced by Pineapple Audio Production. I'm Jess Austin. Thanks for listening.